Welcome to Changemakers with me, Michael Heyman. I'm joined today by Bradley Akabwere. He's a partner at Bully Pulpit International, and what's more, a new presenter on the show. In the future, we're going to share inspiring stories from the US and the UK, both sides of the pond. We sat down earlier together to discuss his inspiring story and his phenomenal track record as an activist for civil rights and an advocate for the best in business. Bradley, welcome to Changemakers. Pleasure to see you. Welcome to the UK. Welcome to London.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's awesome being here. And you guys brought the weather as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, well, I've got to say, you picked the right weather day. That's for sure. Now, look, Bully Pulpit International, it's a new brand for a lot of people in the UK to understand, but not in the US. Let's start with the actual name of the business to start with. In terms of, explain Bully Pulpit for us.
Yeah, absolutely. I know it's kind of a funny term if you're not too familiar with it, but Bully Pulpit really speaks to the almost platform you have in a leadership position to be able to influence change. You know, I think folks most closely associate it with Teddy Roosevelt, and we talk about the Bully Pulpit for change. And we've kind of really taken that philosophy to say, it's not just presidents that have a platform like that. It's leaders across all sectors. Mm-hmm. And so how you use that is up to you. But for organizations that have the ability and you know the innovation to use it well, you'll find that they can make incredible change.
Mm. I mean, and now we know the business is BPI. Two campaigns for President Obama on the digital comms side. I mean, that I suppose is the heritage. Just update us in terms of a sense of the business, what it does, and its capabilities.
Yeah. Well, you hit right at the root. You know, we come from this philosophy that the way that President Obama approached those campaigns brought a lot of new people into the conversation, right? It was all about engagement and using the new tools to do that. And so, you know, our philosophy is that it's not so much about the tools, that is about the approach. And, you know, we have grown from being a small shop that's used to working on political campaigns to working with causes and foundations like Bill and Melinda Gates and so many, you know, big organizations that people think of in terms of affecting change in their communities to corporations. You know, our first client was actually Goldman Sachs during the financial crisis. And so it has been really fun to continue to grow over the years, bolt on new capabilities, and to really think about what does it look like to be a holistic problem-solving organization.
Now, you've got a great story, and you know what I want to do, Bradley, is unpack it for our audience. Now, obviously, you're a partner at BPI, but let's start your story in the Windy City in Chicago. That's the hometown, isn't it? Tell us a little bit.
That's right.
What's the young Bradley thinking about when he leaves uni, when he leaves college, in terms of the world he's going to go into?
Well, so this is an interesting one. I actually started working for Reverend Jesse Jackson while I was in college. That was an amazing experience. You know, iconic civil rights leader, marched with Dr. Martin Luther King, and has developed a long-standing career of civil rights and fighting for justice, economic justice, and otherwise. And so, you know, to have the opportunity to work with him was pretty amazing.
I mean, such an iconic communicator. I mean, yes. I can hear his voice as you're talking about it. Just sort of like open him up for us a bit. So tell us a little bit about how you found him and how you found his personality.
Yeah. Well, I'll start off by saying there was a lesson in how I met him. You know, this was, I'll set the scene just a little bit. This was 2009, when Roxana Saberi was taken political prisoner in Iran. She had been a reporter for the BBC. And, you know, the interesting thing about this is she had attended Northwestern University for her journalism studies. And so a lot of folks were getting together and saying, well, how do we advocate for her release and getting some attention from the State Department and others to focus on this? Well, completely unbeknownst to us, Reverend Jackson had been the first professional interview of her BBC career, and they had maintained a professional relationship. And she, in her current predicament, needed somebody who could have a big platform, a bully pulpit, if you will, to help her try to create a little bit of momentum for that effort. Reverend Jackson actually reached out to a couple of our fellow organizers and said, will you guys join forces with us? Come down to a press conference. I'm going to announce that I'm going to head to Iran to negotiate for her release on humanitarian terms. And I happen to be the one who knew how to get down to the south side of Chicago.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I suppose he's an activist.
Yes.
You're an activist in the sense that actually, I suppose, it would have been before that, would it? In terms of actually your sense, actually you want to make a difference. You
yes.
want to actually get out there and campaign for something. I mean, how early on in your story, Bradley, did you sort of get a sense that actually there was a world you could make a difference in?
Well, it actually happened for me right when I had lost a good friend between my sophomore and junior years of high school. Good friend of mine was shot and killed. It was an unfortunate situation. But not an uncommon one in many urban locations, particularly across the United States. And so for me, I knew not only did I want a different life for myself, but I always wanted to know that I had done everything that I could to change outcomes for folks that were in neighborhoods like mine. And so being able to get in and really invest in trying to make some change in those spaces was important to me from a very young age. And it wasn't until working with folks like Reverend Jackson that I felt like I had the tools and the strategies to be able to.
Because I suppose there's a big question about agency, isn't there, in terms of your feeling that actually either you're overwhelmed by this or actually I can make a difference in this. In terms of how, you know, the advice you'd give to other campaigners about how you find your power, how you find that voice. What's the take out, do you think, from your own experience?
Yeah, I think find your North Star, right? What is the thing that you are really trying to work to accomplish? Because it's really easy to get caught in the day-to-day, and a lot of things are frustrating.
For a lot of people, because it's frustrating,
yeah.
they give up hope. They
yeah.
give up the sense that actually anything can be different. But the thing that I think is interesting, you know, in your career, as well as working with Reverend Jesse Jackson, you've worked on governance reform in Liberia.
Yeah.
You've set up a non-profit, but you've also gone into business and seen business as an agent for change. I mean, a lot of people say, oh, I'd get the first half of that CV. What's the second half in terms of the interest in actually business as the change maker, the force for good?
Yeah, well, I'll take that in two parts, because the reason I ended up going into business was I had been working in Liberia, as you'd pointed out, for the president of Liberia after, you know, 14 years of civil war, 30 years of civil unrest, and I had an opportunity to champion a program that was all about leadership development and capacity building as they were really rebuilding this democracy there. Easy job.
You like a big challenge,
right? Yeah, that's right. That's right. I'll raise my hand and say, we'll figure it out. And, you know, incredible. I'll fast forward through the experience because it was an incredible experience, learned a lot, and I think there was a lot that came out of it. But what I really realized at the end of this was that my opportunities were outpacing my experience. And so what I wanted to do was actually come back to the States and figure out, how do I build more of a foundation around this? Because I think, you know, you asked the question about organizing and folks who are looking to make change, and it's really easy to find people who have the heart, but really finding folks who have the ability to put some constructive parameters around how they approach things and to do it in a way that actually has proven results, that's different.
Right. I mean, I'd imagine a lot of people that you've worked with over time would say, well, I don't trust business. I don't trust them as the good agent. I mean, you've now seen what it's like as an advisor in business, as a spokesperson for a major global aviation company. In terms of how, you know, what's the message you'd give to people in terms of actually what you found on your own journey?
Yeah, I would say, and I didn't come here, Michael, to be the spokesperson for, you know,
you
know, you know, all corporates are great, you know, there's nothing. But I would also say that if you find an organization that's committed to a cause, particularly one that has any size or ability to invest meaningfully, the ability to make change is just tremendous.
Yeah. It brings on to, I suppose, the name of our show is Change Makers, and you know, over time, you and I are going to do a few shows and episodes together. Looking
That'll
forward to that. I mean, and when I think about kind of our coming together, BPI and Seven Hills BPI now, in terms of the common cause was actually we both came across this phrase, change makers. Yes. And I guess my question to you is, what does change makers mean to you? What do, when you think about actually the, I suppose, the character of a change maker, the definition of a change maker, what would you share with us?
Yeah, I think a change maker is someone who does not see limits, right? Someone who says, I want to leave this world in a better place than I found it. And what tools do I have at my disposal to actually bring that outcome about, right? It's not an easy thing to do, but you come to find that there's a lot of people in a loosely connected or even disparate network that are all trying to do this in small ways. And so when you start to connect the dots, I think, as we've started to do here, there's a lot of opportunity.
I mean, I'm going to say another U.S. president on that same vein, John F. Kennedy, but he talks about the moonshot. I sometimes think change makers have got this idea of the moonshot, that kind of audacious goal to actually make that difference. And I guess that's what makes them exciting.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
I'll say this, and there's a couple of things over the course of my career that I found. But when you were put into a situation where you were challenged by something that you think that you are not capable of, that's where you find out where your limits really are. And they're almost always much, much, much more for than you expect, right?
Tell me when you went into the actual comms world, and I'm quite interested in your role as the global director and chief spokesperson for the Boeing company, as sort of like what must have been quite a high profile, pressured situation to get the message right with multiple stakeholders. What did you learn on that beat?
Yeah, Michael, if you'll give me a minute to just kind of lay the framework here. Boeing had two crashes, one in 2018, one in 2019, 6 months apart. Between the two accidents, 346 people were killed. This was a devastating chapter, not only in the company's history, but for many who lost loved ones. And so when you think about the moment that the company was in, they had an opportunity to take a pause and say, what are not only the communications changes we need to make, but frankly, what are the business and leadership choices we need to make?
The soul of the company, I guess. Right?
That's exactly right. And it was a fight for the soul for the company. I would say that, you know, to your question on, you know, the high wire act that we were facing at the time, there were nearly 30 regulators around the world that said, is this a company that we can trust anymore? You had the flying public, you and I, and all the other folks who are on planes all the time, who have never in the past had to think about getting from point A to point B, who are now saying, can we trust an airline that flies a Boeing plane to do that?
Yeah, I mean, and trust is the word, right? I mean, yes. And in terms of actually, I mean, they often call it like the Cinderella asset, don't they? You never quite know what you've got till you've lost it. When you have lost it and you're having to rebuild it, what are the phases, if you like? I mean, can it be explained like that? I mean, is there a journey back to trust?
There is a journey back to trust. It's a very, very long road, and it's a hard road. So anyone who thinks it happens overnight is in the wrong vein here. You know, the reality is the first thing you have to do is understand what is it that people have traditionally believed in you? Because I think as you build a business or you build an organization, a lot of times people aren't taking stock of the things that people actually expect from them. Mm-hmm. You know, it's worked, so it works.
Yeah.
But when you come to realize what people really believed in you for, then to your point, when you lose that, you're now saying, well, here's where we're starting in terms of building it back. I think what we had to do was really go on a journey to understand, you know, what are the actions that we needed to take to make people say, I believe I can actually fly safely again. And then secondly, what are the things that we have to do and say for them to understand, not only have we taken this seriously and moved towards that place, but that we are going to do what we need to do moving forward so that they can believe that.
I suppose it must have been such a fascinating insight into, you know, as you call it, the flying public, the psychology of the flying public, how you build trust there, but also, I suppose, the psychology of leadership, right? You know, in terms of leaders under pressure and actually how leaders do the right thing under pressure.
That's right.
I mean, and I think that is often one of the big, you know, sort of revealers of character, isn't it? Sort of a really tough moment in the life of a company in terms of actually how do the leaders make sure that they own it if it's their fault, that they do something about it, and that they actually they build back that trust as a result.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think there's a nugget of that that's really important for the times that we're in. I think particularly as the political winds have changed in a lot of places, people are asking, well, what do I do now and how do I think about this? And the advice that I always say is figure out where you stand and then actually stand there. Yeah. That's the most important thing that you can do, because once you've figured out that equation, you're not looking around and trying to figure out which way the wind is blowing. Mm-hmm. You may change how you talk about it slightly, but for the most part, your strategy is rooted in what you believe and how that aligns to your overall business strategy.
Right. Now, let's move to today's day job.
Yeah.
You're a partner at BPI. You're advising corporations about reputation. Tell us a little bit more about that side of it in terms of actually the what you're doing at BPI and actually how you find the world of consulting, I suppose, as opposed to the in-house roles, the activist roles. How are you finding the agency life?
Well, the agency life is fun because you get to combine it all.
Yeah,
a little bit,
exactly.
Right? You know,
it's exciting, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. It's super exciting. And look, I'll say this, you know, till I turn blue in the face, you know, the constructs that we put around those identities, I think sometimes are a little bit overdone, because when you get into a role like this, you find whether you're talking advocacy, you're talking, you know, corporate, whether it is, you know, companies finding ways to use their scale for good or companies trying to break into new markets and do really interesting things that have meaning to the people that they're trying to engage. You know, all of this ultimately revolves around, again, what you said, which is trust, right? And trust applies throughout all of this. And so when I think about my job today, it is helping organizations figure out, how do you establish trust? If you have lost trust, how do you rebuild that trust? And in cases where there are questions about it, how do you clarify your message so that it can always bring people back to that point?
And I know that an area, because I've read your pieces on diversity, equity, and inclusion, an area that you feel not only strongly about, but you're advising clients about.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that side of the work. And actually, you know, is there good news here in terms of, you know, is there a battle that is being won in terms of fairness, equality, inclusion? Is it an agenda that's time has come, in your view?
Yeah, it's an agenda that I think has had a step forward, a step back,
yeah.
a step forward, a step back. And this has happened over the course of time. But, you know, as Dr. King said, you know, the moral arc of the universe bends towards justice. Mm. And I do believe that we are in a path right now where we are seeing, particularly in the United States, as we talk about this, some concern about what that future looks like.
He had a great phrase as well, the fierce urgency of now.
Which
I speaks to me on so many levels. I mean, do you think in this area that there is a fierce urgency amongst corporate leaders? I mean, do you get a sense that actually they get it?
Some. I mean, this is a challenging and dynamic time for a lot of leaders who are trying to figure out, how do I balance the commitments that I made to not only my staff, but to the communities in which we operate, while at the same time now trying to recognize that many have felt left out by the articulation of this vision around DEI and what it means. And so, you know, part of what we have to think about in this phase is not only how do we create the progress, but how do we help people understand what that progress looks like in a way that doesn't have them feel left out.
Right. And I suppose that brings us neatly on to the election. You know, we're speaking just days after the presidential election in the States. And of course, you know, it brings into mind, you know, a deeply polarized community, roughly 50-50, I guess, in terms of the support for the Democrats and the Republicans.
Right.
In the UK and indeed Europe and in many parts of the world, it's a difficult political picture to get. I mean, so share some insights for us. Can you make it make sense?
Make it make sense? I don't know. I mean, maybe if we got drinks in here, you know. I would say that the reality is there are people who are deeply, deeply disappointed with their current reality. They are frustrated with, you know, establishment leaders of all parties, right? And folks who are saying, what are the ways in which our governments can invest in us so that our quality of life improves? Because, you know, the data is showing that we are entering a period where there, for the first time in a long time, are generations who are actually economically doing more poorly than their parents' generation did. Mm. And it's felt. And so what I would say is in the U.S. election in particular, voters registered that they want to change. And, you know, I think you could argue there are many different ways to arrive at it. But if we don't wake up to the message that people not only want different, but need different.
Yeah. And I suppose the thing that is, you know, that I suppose unites the political discourse around the world is that, you know, incumbents in all sorts of governments have been overturned by, I guess, the outliers that have come into the fray with answers that communicate well, I guess.
Yeah.
Easy answers, however true or otherwise they are answers, right, that I guess people are looking for from leaders right now.
Yeah. I heard an interesting thing from somebody who was in an urban community in North Philadelphia, who essentially said, you know, I it doesn't matter to me that some politicians are lying to me, but at least they're talking to me and they're listening to me. And what that told me was that not every political party has done a good job of just engaging and by that process, listening to the needs of the folks that they plan to represent.
Is it possible to share a state of mind for a nation? Can you ever do that? But do you get a sense of where the kind of US is at the moment? Because I suppose sitting here in London is that, you know, the US is such an important trading partner. We often talk about the special relationship as being such a sort of, you know, big part of our strategic alliance with the States. And I suppose people are keen to understand, is this an America that's going to sort of step back from the world, or actually will the rhetoric be replaced by a more realistic reality?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think some of that's yet to be seen. I think that there is a real feeling amongst the American public that we have overextended ourselves in a lot of places, but I don't think the average American has a desire for us to not play a leadership role in the world. Mm-hmm. I think the question is, are we playing the right role? And what do tweaks to our engagement look like that inspire confidence, but also prioritize some of the domestic investments that we know we need to make?
Mm. And how does business respond to a changing political agenda? I mean, is this kind of like batten down the hatches and come back in 4 years' time? Or actually, is there a role here now in terms of being the good advocate, being the good citizen, I suppose being the good communicator?
Yeah, well, we always talk about organizations that find ways to use their scale for good. There is an expectation from people that companies and leaders will step in and to do these things, but they also want their organizations to not be tone deaf, right? Speak on the things that you have some stake in. You know, if you're a manufacturing organization, talk about workforce and the skills of the future that are going to allow people to be able to be successful competing, not 5 years from now, but 10 and 15 years from now. But I don't necessarily need to know what you think about X, Y, and Z issue down the road.
Yeah. What have you noticed about London? Now you're back in town. They don't match your tailoring, I can tell you.
That's right. Well, people are very stylish, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, no, you brought it. We need to lift our game. You're back in town. What have you made of it?
One of the things that I love about London is there's such an incredible international metropolitan center, right? Mm. There is a great energy, a great intellect, and a great enthusiasm. And so I always leave more optimistic when I leave London. And I know not everybody says that.
Depends how many days you've had in it. I think it's a hard city, right? You know, lots going on, lots of energy, lots of things. I mean, a lot of people, you go, oh, I've had 5 days in London, I'm exhausted. But I mean, it's what you get with a big international place, isn't it?
Yeah, it's exactly what you get. Well, and that's the beauty of it, right? I think the cities that I have found most interesting around the world are the ones that find ways to bring cultures together and say, what is our collective path forward?
Yeah.
And London just lives and breathes that.
I mean, we obsess in this country about what do others make of us? You know, not just London, but the UK. I mean, we've had Brexit, we've had Boris, we've had, you name it, we've had lots of sort of chapters of change, shall we say, in the UK. I mean, if you would sort of like, you know, give us a view from the other side of the pond in terms of the UK as you see it. I mean, you know, what should our audience take away, do you think?
Well, look, a couple of things. One, the special relationship that you indicated before still feels very much alive and well. You know, this is one of those places where if you're in the United States, there are many people who have not been almost anywhere in the world, and one of the first destinations they want to go to is London.
Right.
And so that has not changed, and I don't see that ever changing. Two, I think when people get here, they're amazed by the culture, the food, the worldliness, and I think that, you know, the elevation of conversation is always excellent. And so all of that's true. And I happened to have come, we said this in the beginning, when the weather is great. I was expecting it not to be, so I was going to use that as
fog
my downside,
rain.
Right? But now I have no downsides.
Bradley, listen, thanks so much for joining me on Changemakers. Can't wait to start working together and doing some interviews. We're going to find some very, very interesting people along the way, I'm sure.
We sure will. I look forward to it. Thank you so much.